The outdoors isn't always a fun, happy place. It can often be a site of torture and crime and mayhem, but we have a right to it, and we have an opportunity to restore that connection to a way that's much more positive and more healing.
That's Baratunde Thurston, host of the PBS series, America Outdoors, reflecting on the role of nature in American culture and history. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
My name is Baratunde Thurston. I'm a writer, activist, sometimes comedian, and I'm all about telling a better story of us.
Now starting its second season, America Outdoors with Baratunde Thurston isn't your typical travel program. Among Thurston's stops, the site of a forgotten racial massacre in Elaine, Arkansas, and Tanier Island, which is disappearing into the Chesapeake Bay due to climate change.
I think most of these episodes leave you feeling better than when you started. There are hard stories in some of them, but we're mostly focusing on people who've created this positive connection where often there was none.
Thurston also uses the program to explore and bridge cultural divides.
In that spirit, me going out on a shooting range in Arkansas, or on a turkey hunt in New Mexico, or on a crab boat in the Chesapeake Bay, on a ranch in Idaho with people who I know explicitly are very, very different from me with a different ideology and a different politics, is a really healthy exercise.
Thurston is known for using humor to confront tough topics. He's worked at The Onion, The Daily Show, and delivered a widely praised TED Talk deconstructing racism.
Thurston is a British name, but we are not British. Shout out to the multi-generational dehumanizing economic institution of American chattel slavery, though.
A modern-day Renaissance man, Thurston also hosts a podcast called How to Citizen, in which the word citizen is a verb and is a founding partner in the digital media startup Puck. One of his main interests, artificial intelligence. To illustrate his concern about AI, he even allowed the creation of a deepfake version of himself.
All right. Welcome, techno adventurers and curiosity connoisseurs.
It was a deepfake version of you.
That's correct.
How do we inoculate ourselves against the downside?
I don't really have much patience for the idea that, well, technology's just gonna technology. You can't slow it down. We can and we do all the time. And I think it's really important for us to remember, especially in a democratic society, small d, we have powers here.
Baratunde Thurston, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here, Margaret.
Stand-up comedy, digital media, best-selling author, successful podcast, a PBS series based on the outdoors. You've been at the forefront of several new platforms, media ventures. What's the through line for you that connects the various pursuits you've been involved in?
It's quite an opening question. I see why they call it Firing Line. The through line is, how do we get to the future? And the through line is my mother. My mom was a computer programmer. My mom was a community organizer and a politically active person. My mom was very Black, as am I. And my mother was an avid lover of the outdoors and our connection to nature. So the through line starts in my childhood because I had exposure to all these different things. And now that I'm somewhat grown, I add another story to make my life make more sense, to say it's about how we enter the future. And technology is driving a lot of that. I feel like we have to do it together. Citizen as a verb, which is the name of one of my projects. And I feel like we have to stay connected to Earth even as we reach for these stars and live in these clouds.
Arnita Thurston.
Yes.
Was your mom's name.
Yes.
You describe her as a pro-Black, Pan-African, tofu-eating hippie who had me memorizing the countries of Africa and reading about apartheid before my 10th birthday. How'd she shape your ideas?
With love and high standards. She shaped my ideas with a lot of exposure. I remember noticing my friends' parents who had very specific ideas of what the parents wanted their kids to be. My mother never said, be a doctor, be a writer, be an actor, but she did sign me up for everything, not always asking me first. So she signed me up for Boy Scouts, she signed me up for Taekwondo, she signed me up for the youth orchestra program that my older sister, Belinda, was also in. And through exposure, she shaped my ideas.
You're a New York Times bestselling author. The book you wrote was a satirical memoir.
Yes.
How to Be Black.
Bing.
You explore the concept of blackness, whiteness, white supremacy, and your personal experience. You write, quote, "My version of being black adheres as much to the stereotypes as it dramatically breaks from them." Tell me about your version of being black.
It keeps evolving. My version of being black right now is focused on how to heal beyond being aware of the traumas of being black. My version is focused on how to find joy and this elusive concept of freedom, which for a lot of my life has been an external appeal to others to recognize me. And quite recently, I've come to the obvious conclusion that that is not a path to freedom, but it took me decades and decades of running down that path to realize it's pretty unsatisfying. Mm. And so right now, my blackness is loving, joyful, healing, and continually expansive.
What precipitated that awareness for you?
Fatigue. I think 2020 meant a lot of things to a lot of folks around the world, especially in this nation, with respect to COVID directly, but also what COVID revealed. And in terms of the racial dynamics of the United States and who was on the front lines and George Floyd and countless others whose names we no longer so easily remember, it was a shocking awakening of pain. Pain that I was already aware of, but that moment stripped of my ability to travel around and distract myself was very sad. It was very sad. I found myself to be very, very exhausted. I'd already written the book, How to Be Black. I'd already done a big TED talk about how to end racism. Apparently not enough people watched it. And so here we are, reliving this same psychodrama of our sort of unhealed wounds as a nation. And that precipitated a lot of inner work, a lot of gardening and fighting with squirrels over tomatoes in my backyard, a lot of long conversations with my wife, a lot of quiet, forced contemplation due to being locked in my house by regulations or at least recommendations. And in that silence, I started hearing something else. And it was the voice of people like Octavia Butler, who long predates me with her wisdom, but I was late to discover it, that focused on the imagination and the creation of a possible future, even though we are still here in this present. And so I started shifting into this duality of, okay, I gotta kind of practice being free before I'm free so that when I get free, I'm ready for that freedom, which means casting the mind and the spirit to a place that isn't quite real, but is so free. And there's a lot of joy and happiness there. So I live in that space, even as I live right here in this space.
Well, once you got outdoors, you took a PBS series to the outdoors.
Yes.
America Outdoors with Baratunde Thurston recently started its second season.
Yes.
You travel across the United States, Georgia, Oregon, Maine, and you explore how nature shapes the American life and Americans' relationship with the outdoors. You say your goal as a storyteller is to, quote, tell a better story of us. How do you do that?
With great difficulty. First, I acknowledge that we are living in fragmented stories of me and you that separate us from becoming an us. And I think from our political leaders to some of the business language we use to pop culture, we are isolated from each other. The algorithms do it too. And so if you're feeling a sense of separation, it's because the story we're living in is designed to separate us from each other. So that creates a need for some more connected tale that puts us on the same side of something. And this show has helped a lot. It's helped me see the country and feel the country, touch and even taste the country, and not just think about or have opinions about the country. It's really different to be with all the difference in this country in the same boat, on the same trail with someone else. So I've gotten to see the country and its beauty and people's connection to land and nature in a really direct way. That helps a lot. The other thing that helps tell a story of us is just reminding myself that we are a we. that we're stronger when we're together, that individualism has such an important place, but not the only place in our identities. And this show, plus some of my other work, has repeated the same lesson that when we work together, we go farther. And when we try to do everything by ourselves, we end up alone.
Talk to me about how this series and being in the outdoors and being connected to the outdoors has helped connect the tissue or help in the connective tissue for you. I mean, you have referenced when you were growing up that your mother would take you on Saturdays to REI and you would spend your Saturdays looking at different, you know, camping equipment and
drooling
tents.
Over camping gear.
And that she really introduced you to the outdoors.
Yeah.
She
said, go outside. That was the introduction. Go outside.
So get you had out a relationship with the outdoors.
Yes, I did.
So how was this different?
I have more years and I've had some distance. As a kid, I was a Boy Scout. As a kid, I went on hikes and camping trips with my mom to help me and my friends stay out of trouble in what was becoming more troubled neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. in the 80s, like a lot of cities. As I got older, I got more enamored with the connection through technology, through screens and all that, and I drifted a bit from nature. I moved to New York City. It's a concrete jungle. That's kind of a metaphor, kind of a reality. And so I strayed from that essential connection. This show has helped bring me back to my childhood, helped bring me back to that sense of wonder and play and joy. And more importantly than just my own direct experience, the show has connected me with other people who live this way more often than not. People who work in the outdoors, who we don't often showcase, indigenous people who we often overlook and pretend they only exist in history books, folks with various disabilities for whom outdoor access is not made easy, but they strive and overcome and figure it out anyway. And a lot of kids, so many kids I've gotten to play with outside, which really helps bring out the inner child in all of us. So that has done a lot of good for me. And I think it's done good for the people who see these stories as well.
Has it been healing for you?
Directly. There's been, the show was far more emotional than I ever understood it would be. I was in the Chesapeake Bay in a very small town called Tangier Island. Highly conservative, highly Trumpy town. I'm not highly conservative or highly Trumpy, but they welcomed me in and they make great crab cakes, which is a good way to get me to your town. And I'm hanging out with the mayor and he takes me to the shoreline. And as we walk along the shore, I see tombstones in and out of the water. This town is being inundated by rising seas. And he told me the story through nearly wet eyes of having to exhume his own ancestor to bury him as close as possible in his own front yard. Those tears that he nearly shed reflected very similarly upon the Shoshone Bannock people in Idaho. We were on the Salmon River to do a traditional salmon hunt, and they called off the hunt because there weren't enough salmon. And the salmon that were there were practically cooked in the overly hot waters. Climate change explains both of these phenomena to different people who would never necessarily have connected directly to each other, but have the same emotional experience. Seeing that, I felt a healing for the rift that we often experience in this country. More directly, I've hung out with veterans and people recovering from substance abuse disorder who use the outdoors as a direct path to healing their minds, healing their psyches, healing their bodies. And in a collective sense, Black folk who've been through so much on this land, indigenous folk who've been through so much on this land. The outdoors isn't always a fun, happy place. It can often be a site of torture and crime and mayhem. But we have a right to it. And we have an opportunity to restore that connection to a way that's much more positive and more healing. So I've witnessed collective versions of healing for big groups of people who are taking back their place with nature.
You've called climate change the uninvited co-star.
Climate change shows up in every episode and it doesn't demand any kind of payment, but it demands to be heard.
In Maine, you went out with ice harvesters who had found their supply had been greatly reduced, discovered big changes in oyster and lobster industries. Mm-hmm. What do you hope the audience takes from the program?
Ooh, that I do my own stunts. I also hope they take away a number of things. How beautiful this country really is, physically, humanely beautiful. You see the landscape, you see the wildlife, you see the people in the landscape with the wildlife. It's a really beautiful picture. And it's an image of ourselves we don't often see. I want people to take away that nature is a part of us, not apart from us. Mm. And there are so many different ways to restore that lost connection. And I want people to really take away something positive and hopeful. I think most of these episodes leave you feeling better than when you started. There are hard stories in some of them, but we're mostly focusing on people who've created this positive connection where often there was none. And when it comes to something like climate, we're finding a lot of solutions. We're visiting regenerative ranches in Oregon. I didn't know what that was until I went there. And a regenerative mine in Arkansas. I didn't know what that was until I went there. And indigenous folks bringing back plants, which brings back birds that we thought were extinct. Mm-hmm. So we have a role to play in healing this whole planet, which also helps heal us. I want people to take a lot from the show, apparently.
One of the episodes, you meet with an Iraq War veteran who is treating his post-traumatic stress by immersing himself in nature.
Yeah.
What is your observation about how nature can heal us?
Nature is in a constant process of healing. So it's a natural role model, no pun intended. But we move through with a tractor or a trail and nature bounces back, or some predator comes through and drives off a herd and they come back, or a storm comes through. We're not always the cause of the interruption, but nature is this cyclical thing and it wants to live. Like life finds a way. Jurassic Park, remember that back in the day? It's true. And so when I'm feeling broken or beaten down, defeated or hurt in some way, nature is a friend. Nature is a role model. Nature is a path that I can look to. So that's one way. The other's more direct. Nature feels good a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. I went on an extraordinary experience in a forest in Oregon, in Western Oregon, forest bathing. And the idea is you just move slowly with intention through the forest, but these trees emit chemicals or hormones. I don't remember exactly which, but they emit something that soothes us, that lowers our blood pressure and our heart rates, and it's proven by science. And I felt that. Nature literally heals. There are herbs and plants that can stop bleeding and help with wounds. We've known all this. Nature is a medicine cabinet, as Louis Hina, who I was on the Rio Grande in New Mexico, said literally. This, when I look at this river, he said, I see my altar and my church. I see my playground. And I see my pantry, and I see my medicine cabinet, all in one.
Yeah.
So it provides. I think I've gotten so accustomed to the modern world and all of these layers between me and nature, physical and metaphorical, that I can forget that we come from this. So it's home. It's sometimes rough, and I don't like poison ivy as much as the next person does, but it's there for us.
There's the natural component, but then there's also this component where you are walking with and experiencing people who come from fundamentally different cultures than you've inhabited. People who know your biography know that you grew up in the 1980s in Washington, D.C., that your own life was touched by gun violence, that in this episode or in this series, you actually, you remark about your discomfort with guns, and then you spend time in Arkansas trap shooting, in New Mexico, shooting turkeys, experiencing Americans who have fundamentally different relationships with firearms than perhaps people who grew up in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Has this experience helped heal cultural divides for you, or can it?
It has helped. Back in 2008, I went door-to-door campaigning for Barack Obama. Prior to that, I'd done a little bit of on-the-ground politics for local folk, but this was the first national campaign where I knocked on a stranger's door for someone I believed in. And prior to that, I was just online, talking smack, blogging my face off, doing the social media thing, feeling right, because I was, I thought. But it was very easy to have ideas about other people I never had to interact with. Mm-hmm. And when you're standing on somebody's porch, it's just a little harder to say some of the things I might have tweeted about them or blogged about them. There's a forced respect with that proximity. We've lost some of that in the country, but I think it's still there more than it's not. In that spirit, me going out on a shooting range in Arkansas or on a turkey hunt in New Mexico or on a crab boat in the Chesapeake Bay, on a ranch in Idaho with people who I know explicitly are very, very different from me with a different ideology and a different politics is a really healthy exercise. Mm-hmm. Because we don't start with the talking points. We start with, hello. We start with, welcome. We start with, what are we here to do? We have a little micro moment of a story of us right there. I'm here to learn from you. And you know who I am, and you still invited me. So you're here to share and learn from me as well. So cultural divides, really big concept, really big word, and there are reasons we have such huge ones. But we also have opportunities to close them through relationships. And a lot of us don't have those relationships, and this show has given me even more of a privilege to explore beyond the talking points where other people are coming from.
So take something specific like firearms.
Yeah.
What did you learn about sportsmen and firearms and the relationship people have with guns in this country that maybe you didn't know previously?
I learned or relearned that it's a lot of fun.
Pull.
Eyes on it, touch the bottom.
No! You did it!
I had fun. I was learning. I was getting good. I love validation. So when, you know, Kaylee Browning, a U.S. silver medalist in sport clay shooting said, you did a good job there. I'm like, I did a good job. Yay. And the little, you know, A-grade seeking student in me is very pleased with himself. So in that sense, I got some validation. It was also fun to be outside in that way. And I remember feeling like, oh, I'm in nature doing this. Mm. I'm not in front of a screen. Even though there's an explosion right near my shoulder, which kind of interrupts some of the zen of the moment, in between that, I'm noticing and I'm hearing and I'm smelling and I'm hyper alert. And I was aware of how different I felt versus standing on a city street corner. I learned about the deep amount of respect that all kinds of hunters, and I put people who fish in this category as well, have for the lives of animals.
Have you found that connecting with others who are different can help you bridge political divides, cultural divides?
I think it can bridge initially psychological divides.
Yeah.
And just the idea that I might not have anything to say to a person from over there or down there or out there is thrown out the window the moment we share a moment of laughter, a smile, eye contact. Then it's another person. They become another person, and hopefully I become another person too. I think with the Arkansas moment with Kaylee and Anne-Marie DeRamus was the other person I was with, who's on the Game and Fish Commission. We talked about my history with gun violence. My father was shot and killed when I was a young child. They were telling me they had not had that experience so close to them. They don't know people for whom that's been true. And we had follow-ups, me and Kaylee, after that. I don't know that we're on the same page, but we are closer in the book. And it wasn't just me who felt some opening. So did she. And we both were like, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't see it that way. I've never experienced that myself. And it was valuable for both of us, I know, to see someone hearing us. And a lot of what gets in our way is everybody wants to talk. And nobody wants to hear. And it's very easy with distance to do that. And as our media picks and chooses alignment for us and reinforces that, you got to go really far outside of your natural pathways to even find someone different sometimes. Yeah. So again, this is one of the blessings of the show.
You had to go to Elaine, Arkansas.
I had to go to Arkansas. And in Elaine, I found something else completely mind-altering and heart-rending, to be honest with you, in terms of the history of that town.
Well, I want to ask you about that. Yeah. I mean, you found there had been a massacre in Elaine, Arkansas in 1919 that had been completely written out of history. How'd you stumble into it?
I have a really good team around me. I can't pinpoint who found this story exactly how, but I do know it was a shock. I wrote a book called How to Be Black. I know a lot of Black history things. It's part of the job. I never heard of Elaine and this massive race massacre that went down in 1919.
So what happened in the Elaine race massacre of 1919?
It's known as the Red Summer. Summer of 1919, very bloody.
Yeah.
Lots of towns in this country had white uprisings to crush Black progress in one way or the other. In Elaine, a group of sharecroppers had been organizing to demand better payment for their labor, more transparency in their pricing, and the opportunity to buy their own land. They organized in a church meeting, about 100 of them. They hired a lawyer. That was the purpose of the meeting. Let's talk to the lawyer, how we advocate for ourselves with these plantation owners. Plantation owners sent a little delegation of armed dudes, and shots were fired. And one of those men, at least one of them, was killed. And that set forth what should have been the justice system. Sheriff comes, takes statements, arrests people, collect evidence. There's a whole line of stuff that in due process in a democratic society, we would go through. That sheriff, like so many others in that time, and too many since, chose violence. Rounded up a posse, encouraged the whole town to lay waste to the Black part of town. Called up the governor, claimed there was a Black insurrection. The opposite of what was happening, which was the common excuse of the time and a lot since. 500 federal troops come in by train, bearing Gatling gun, a very automated firing weapon of its era, essentially a machine gun. And they train those weapons on the Black part of town. And they take food that people had stored up. And sharecropping's hard work. You don't have a lot left over. So people had stuff stored up for the seasons, all gone, homes destroyed, babies killed. So the estimate is 200 to 1,000.
It's a pretty wide range. Were there artifacts from that, from the massacre there, or only historical memory?
There are some artifacts in terms of press coverage.
Uh-huh.
There are memories. One of the ironies of this case is that the only people ever charged with the crime were Black people who were sentenced to the death penalty. They did not end up going through with that sentence. There was a lot of great legal work that took place to get those sentences commuted or in some other way not applied. But that memory is deep in Elaine. I came to that town with a bicycling group, Bike POC, and we rolled in on those former train tracks, which are now a bike path. And it was the picture of a multiracial democracy ad. It's Black, brown, white, every shade of people, every shape of person, every gender representation rolling in to meet the mayor, who was the first Black mayor of this town. The first woman mayor of this town, and a descendant of that massacre.
Oh, wow.
And the most shocking thing to me, of all the shocking things I learned about Elaine, is that this mayor did not know about the massacre until 15 years ago. And she is not 15 years old, or 20 years old, or 25 years. I'm not going to say her age, because that'd be disrespectful. But there were ways that someone should have known in a country that teaches the truth of its history.
Why is it so easy for us to have forgotten so many of these events?
Because we set up systems to make it hard to remember. Because we erased it. So in this case, in this town, the white leaders of the town made it very clear to the remaining Black residents, you don't ever speak of this, or it'll happen again. You know what can happen. This is not a theoretical threat. This is a threat backed by very recent traumatic events. So generation to generation, no one talked about it. Add shame to that. Why would you talk about losing so much like this? So fear and shame will have us forget a lot of who we are and what we've been through.
I want to turn to technology now.
Let's go.
When you were an undergraduate at Harvard,
yes,
a lot of people came to you for tech support.
They did. It was literally my job. I still get calls.
From your Harvard classmates?
Yes.
For like, to teach me how do I...
My iPhone's acting up. What can I... Help me out.
At the Aspen Ideas Festival this year, you led an AI workshop.
Yes.
And you introduced it with this video.
All right. Welcome, techno adventurers and curiosity connoisseurs. I'm Baratunde Thurston, your tour guide on this digital safari into the wilds of artificial intelligence. I've got more titles than a royal wedding, TV host, podcaster, storyteller. But today we're all co-pilots on this thrill ride into the digital unknown.
Okay, so now it's time for the big reveal. That was not you.
No, that was definitely not me.
It was a deep fake
yes,
version of you.
With my consent that a friend of mine named Peter made for me. Peter
okay.
wrote for it.
But the script and the voice and the video were all generated by AI.
That's correct.
What's the point of showing that?
Entertainment, provocation, demonstration, learning opportunity, silliness, all rolled in one.
But what are the consequences of AI's ability to be able to fake you?
Yeah. Part of what is happening and will continue to happen with these generative AI technologies is that our ability to trust the information around us will decline. Mm-hmm. Because we will have convincing facsimiles of reality produced not in our best interest or the interest of the truth. So part of the value of that demonstration was it's clearly not quite there yet. You see what I sound like now, and that wasn't it. But in months, maybe years, certainly no more than that, that could be a near perfect replica. And so part of the reason I did that workshop was to inspire thought about AI through direct experience, not just reading about it or hearing someone else's opinion. And then when we see something like that, we get to ask ourselves, what do we want to do? How do we want to govern and restrict and regulate this? Do we want to allow this at all? In some cases, there's fun and useful applications of things like that. In others, it will most certainly undermine our civic fabric and our ability to self-govern and live together.
You have expressed skepticism.
Yes.
About AI's, as a technology, as it becomes more advanced, more widely accessible. Elon Musk and Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of Apple, have signed a letter saying we should slow down the investment and the work and the progress on artificial intelligence. Where do you come down on this idea? Should we slow it down? Can we slow it down? How do we inoculate ourselves against the downside?
We can slow it down. And I do think it's important for we the people to reassert our agency and our role in the world that we want to live in. We are not just consumer victims of the market and a handful of geniuses who bestow trinkets upon us at their whim. We have slowed down so many things in this country. We have slowed down access to healthcare for certain people in certain circumstances. We have slowed down access to guns. Some folks think not enough, others think too much, but we have literally slowed down cars. Mm-hmm. We have a speed limit and consequences for crossing over that. So I don't really have much patience for the idea that, well, technology is just going to technology. You can't slow it down. We can and we do all the time. So what do we want to do and how do we want to impose that? I think it's very important. I think it's really important for us to remember, especially in a democratic society, small d, we have powers here. We have and need to have consent and control and some compensation in some cases for these AI systems for how they affect us.
One of your major themes is citizenship.
Yeah.
Right? You have this podcast, How to Citizen, Citizen, where citizen is a verb.
Yes.
What you just said was technology and artificial intelligence can get in our way of citizenship.
They can help and they can hurt. My refrain, it's really constant. Sometimes I annoy myself. Add more people. Add the voice of the people. We have gone through a decade or so of social media without much active say. There's a handful of companies, and big tech is a whole thing I don't really need to explain, but I didn't sign up for having the word friend apply to every human I might have interacted with for 5 seconds up to 5 years. That great flattening of real relationships was not an active choice. And there are other ways that we could build this. So I am so not anti-technology. I'm a product of technology. I'd probably be dead without technology due to surgeries and all sorts of things. But I do think that we have to assert our will more clearly and more collectively in these choices, because these tools will destabilize our position, not just employment-wise, but with each other. They'll destabilize our opportunities, and in some cases, they'll destabilize the truth. So we should be very, very, very careful. And they can help. They can also hurt. We should be the difference makers, not just a handful of us.
How to Citizen is the title of the podcast.
Yes.
Citizen is an active verb.
Mm-hmm.
What's the premise?
The premise is that there's so many different ways to answer this. Part of the reason this show started is because I was frustrated with only hearing bad news. Only hearing everything that we're doing that's failing. We can't govern ourselves. We can't pass bills. We can't reform police. We can't. And yet I knew another truth, that we were resolving many things. There are people I know and places I've visited directly who have made tremendous progress on the climate challenge or on public safety or on health. And we're not hearing those stories. And so part of the premise is that we need to shine a light on the people already practicing this renewed citizening, this renewed democracy that we all deserve and say we want. And then beneath that high-level premise, there's a meaning of what citizen as a verb should actually look like and should actually feel like.
Which is?
Four things. To citizen is to show up. It's very simple in that regard. You show up and participate. To citizen is to invest in relationships with yourself, with others, and with the planet around you. To citizen is to understand and engage with power. It's not a dirty word, and we have so many different ways of building and wielding it. And to citizen is to commit to the collective, not just our individual self, but think about the we that we're a part of, whether it's family, block, neighborhood, community, county, nation, planet. We've got to see ourselves as more than solo atoms drifting through the universe alone. That's not fun.
Were you driven to focus on citizenship because you felt there was a declining interest in participating? Or are you worried about civics on some level?
I was driven to it, like many things, by my mother. My mom was a spectacular person, and I'm not trying to give her over credit, but I'm also trying to be honest about some of where these sparks started.
Moms can never get too little credit, in my view.
Moms was... She was out in these streets. I went to demonstrations with her. She was encouraging me to read, and she exposed me to things, as I have said. And she had really big hopes for me and for my sister, Belinda, that we'd figure out how we'd live together when democracy and capitalism had failed. I was like 10, 11 years old when she dropped this on me. Mm. It's not a normal homework assignment. Mm-hmm. I struggled greatly because my armpits had just started sweating the week before, so I had other matters on my mind at the time. So that got planted and then deferred. Now, yes, I worry about how we are going to live together. And I believe that we can. So that combination means I got to do something. If I don't like what I'm seeing and I see another possibility and I've got any ounce of energy, then I'm going to try to nudge us in this direction. And my way of doing that is to tell the story of it. Because I think the story of who we are shapes how we are. And if we only hear that we can't get along, that we're eternally divided, that we're incompetent and bitter rivals in every dimension, then we will be all those things. I think we can be a lot more than that. I've seen a lot more than that. So that's the story I'm choosing to tell.
So in a 2020 episode, you said, quote, voting is mad important. Don't get me wrong. It's very important, but it's not the whole game. Right?
I did say that. I definitely said that.
And you really have to think about it. Yes. Voting is delegating power.
Yes.
We have a lot of energy devoting to giving power over professional politicians.
Yeah.
What is the responsibility of a citizen after he or she has voted?
Mindset-wise, is to think of ourselves as employers.
Yeah. You don't think we do that?
Not on a day-to-day basis. I know I don't. And the people I'm in touch with directly and the people I hear about indirectly, we primarily do not show up as bosses. That's one element. I think it is our duty to maintain some level of awareness of what's being done in our name and with our resources on our behalf. And I recognize that's really hard, especially for people working multiple jobs, barely have time to handle the basics of life. And so it's also incumbent upon us to create a system where that's not the case, where people have space and time to contribute to our collective existence. It's our job to govern ourselves. Elected office is one path, not the only one. There are so many other ways we can show up and invest in relationships and understand power and commit to our collective.
I mean, you're talking about citizenship. You're also talking about basic understanding of civics.
Yeah.
There's lamentably a generation of individuals in this country who would struggle to pass the basic citizenship test that immigrants in this country
have to pass. Oh, I'd say almost everyone born here would fail that test. Immigrants, they literally get the job done when it comes to documenting their understanding of how the system here works, because most of us aren't tested on that.
Does that concern you?
It does, especially in an environment where we are vilifying immigrants or making things harder, you know, for folks, for the people who have to explicitly prove their allegiance and loyalty versus those of us born here.
Does it concern you there's a generation of individuals who don't have basic understandings of our own civics and
Absolutely.
What it takes to maintain a representative democracy?
The short answer, yes, it concerns me. I think it concerns me in two ways, though. One is on the information and the mechanics of how our system is established and functions, right? That is data. The other is on the behavior, the habits, the norms, the muscle of how we interact with and relate to each other. How do we disagree? How do we converse? How do we share power? That's a practice.
Yeah.
So you have knowledge and you have practice. And we are woefully underperforming in both.
In 2021, after the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, you said of our country, quote, "We're just people capable of anything. We're capable of turning this democracy into a theocracy or an oligarchy or an aristocracy or an authoritarian regime. And we can become Hungary. We can become Russia." As you look ahead to 2024 and the presidential election, how do you assess the risks to our democracy?
They are high. I don't have a number. I don't have a rating or a score, but they persist. January 6th was not the end. It was another milestone in a possible trajectory. I still more firmly believe it's up to us. I remember using all those fancy words. That sounded pretty good. But
how? So when you say it's up to us, what is up to us?
It's up to us to choose why we remain together. It's up to us to choose to affirm our connection to each other. It's up to us to choose what we will and will not tolerate in terms of behavior from our elected, appointed, or otherwise ascended leaders. And we know some essential truths. We often choose to forget it because we want to belong to a group here or there, but it is up to us to make that decision for ourselves, what we stand for. And I think it's up to us to find ways to assert that shared reality and that shared belonging. It doesn't have to mean standing in defense at the Capitol. It's very dramatic. It doesn't have to mean running for office yourself, though we need more good people to do that. It can mean deciding how you relate to law enforcement in your community, to your neighbors, to your fellow church members, to your child's teachers. Mm-hmm. Are you showing up and yelling epithets at a parent meeting? What kind of behavior are we modeling? That is up to us. No one's making people do all these things. We are drawn to them because there's some sense of reward in it. And some of that reward is a sense of belonging. So it's also up to us to make that belonging reward pro-social behavior, community behavior, true actual patriotic behavior, which is loving the country and truly knowing the country, not just saying you love it, as in any real relationship. Easy to say you love someone. Proof is in the behavior. So all of that is up to us. And I don't think there's any foregone conclusion that we are going to become Hungary or we're going to become Russia. I think we are at a very key moment to actively decide. It's up to us. What do we want to become? And I take that as an affirmative possibility. There's a lot of statements about democracies in crisis. Democracy's dying. It is. Some of it is in crisis. Some of it is dying. We started talking about how to be Black and some of my Black upbringing. There's a big part of my Black upbringing that understands this democracy wasn't designed for me. In many ways, it wasn't designed for you, right? There are a lot of us who are not included in that original set of charters. But here we are. It's up to us, as it has been always in a system by, of, and for the people. So let's go.
How do you assess the risk to democracy of a second Trump presidency?
Yeah. I think the risk to democracy of a second Trump presidency is extraordinary. I think he and the people who are rewarded by him having power have made it very clear that they don't appreciate the voice of the people. That from something as simple as counting and certifying votes, which January 6th was about, it's a really basic function, to the ideas of the court system and final rulings of judges and intimidation of witnesses. There's a lot of demonstration that at least while they are in power, they're very interested in concentrating more and more power and not allowing the checks and balances of the system that we've grown to admire and try to make more perfect run as it should. So yeah, I think it's a big threat.
If you could issue one challenge to everyone who listens to you to fulfill their duty as citizens between now and the next election, what would it be?
Okay. Here's the setup and then here's the answer. The setup is a woman named Adrienne Marie Brown. She was a guest on our podcast, an activist, a community leader, a really thoughtful philosopher, I'd call her. And she reminded me of this concept of fractals, that these are these mathematical patterns that repeat at every scale, the tiny microscopic to the cosmic macroscopic. And you see it in our lungs, in a forest, they kind of look the same in terms of their network structure. So the premise of that way of thinking is that what we do at any level affects what happens at every level. So when it comes to a question like that, my default would be like, you got to vote the right way and make sure the bad person, whoever you think that is, doesn't get power. But I think that's too simplistic. And I think in a true people-powered system, we all have power. So I would encourage people to think about that ripple effect and think about your own sphere of influence and where you can citizen. And I'd encourage people to ask themselves a question. Find someone else in your community and ask them, what does this community need to thrive? And let that begin a fractal process of collectively deciding what it is we want, what it is we need, and through that process, figuring out how we get it. And the question of an election of a particular person, that will be an outcome of a process like that. I don't think that's where it starts. I think that's where it ends up.
In 1967, William F. Buckley Jr., hosted Groucho Marx on this program, on the original version of Firing Line.
Yeah.
His very first question to the great comedian was, is the world funny?
No, I don't think it's terribly funny, you know. I don't think it's ever terribly funny. Sometimes there are isolated pieces of the world that is funny, but generally it's a pretty serious world. It always has been.
What's your answer to Buckley's question? Is the world funny?
I laughed out loud when I heard the question because I thought about this funny little caterpillar I saw when we were out filming America Outdoors, and it had these beady red antenna, and it was the cutest, fuzziest thing, and it clung to the car. And I'm driving like 50 miles an hour, and this caterpillar's just clinging on for dear life, and that made me bust out laughing. I think the world's hilarious. I think nature's funny. I think most humans are funny. I think I'm funny if I let myself loose a little bit. So yeah, I think the world is actually quite a funny place, though I respect his answer about the serious nature of things.
But you disagree with Groucho Marx.
I do. I am willing to go on the record. I disagree with Groucho Marx. The world is hilarious.
How do you come to your comedy?
Initially through anger and disappointment and a need to make sense of something that felt like it didn't make sense. So I would find the absurdity in a thing and lean on that to explain what I was seeing. That was my initial inspiration to get into comedy so many years ago. Now, it's less about the anger. It's still about the absurdity. Something that feels out of place, it requires an explanation, is still an inspiration for a possible joke or a possible sideways of looking at the situation. And for me, maintaining my sanity in looking at something that doesn't quite make sense, including a funny little caterpillar on my windshield at 50 miles an hour. It doesn't always have to be a serious thing, but it has to be something askew.
So comedy's also a way, it sounds like, for you to get to the harder truths.
It's a way of making sense, yes. It is a way of explaining, it is a way of understanding.
And
a way of surviving.
You write in your book, also, it's a way of getting at difficult issues like race.
Yeah.
How'd you use comedy to get at race?
Oh, man. I make a lot of reparations jokes. It makes folks uncomfortable, and I love that. I think that's hilarious. I don't have...
Can you tell me off, one?
It's not like I have a reparations bit.
Yeah.
I just throw it in, sprinkle it in conversation like sugar and tea. and folks don't see it coming. And it just puts it back on the agenda, even when there's no agenda. Yeah. You're like, oh, I haven't thought about reparations in a while. Let me just throw that out there. But what the way that I think about comedy and race and how I've done it is there are a lot of hard truths and hard things to talk about with race. I use myself as an example, and I do some self-deprecating thing, and I demonstrate some vulnerability about me and how I was an awkward teenager with acne. And my mom gave me sports goggles as my only glasses. That's hilarious. But as a teenager, that's cruel and unusual punishment. And she probably should have been, you know, brought up on some kind of parental alert system for doing that to her little boy. But when I talk about that, when I show that image, people see an adorable, super awkward little boy. And then we can start talking about policing. It's not a hard cut from one to the other, but it lays the groundwork. And it's, I think if I'm, as I continue to think about it, for me, the comedy is a way to build a relationship. Even a silly little joke. If two people are laughing, those two people agree with each other for a moment. And it bypasses the appropriate part of the brain sometimes. You're like, I shouldn't be laughing at this, but oh, you got me. And so there's a channel open between two folks in that moment of laughter. And so what are you going to slide into that channel?
The series is America Outdoors with Baratunde Thurston.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Thank you. I survived the firing line.
You survived.
This was such a pleasure. Thank you.